listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of White Flight by Abigail Tracy. None of the individuals in the photo responded to questions about their potential involvement in the Capitol riot. But the rally, which Trump promised beforehand would be wild, was an amuse-bouche, and flying a private jet to attend it is not an example of passive politics. As court documents and Justice Department indictments reveal, for many alleged insurrectionists, it was Trump's rhetoric leading up to and during the Stop the Steal rally that motivated them, a dark reality that ultimately laid the foundation for his impeachment. It's hard to say what being identified might mean for the people in the picture. Do they regret having gone to the rally? Do they disavow the violent events that followed it? If so, they did not take the opportunity to tell Vanity Fair. Neither did they embrace their leader. So what is the culture that cradles such individuals? And what happens in the communities where they live, work, and wield influence? Dobbs did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Dan McEwen declined to speak to the magazine when reached by phone and did not respond to further questions sent via email. Campbell, Bob McEwen, and the Smiths did not respond to multiple requests for comment from Vanity Fair. Zanone died unexpectedly on February 26th. You guys are relative masters of the universe, yet you feel the need to be up there and participate in this coup, says one Memphis-born source who is younger but knows a number of the private jet playgroup members through various social connections. What happened that you decided not only this is your guy, but that you're going to hop on a private jet and go up there and participate in this? A Tale of Two Cities. Trump handily won Tennessee in the 2020 election with 61% of the vote. But in Shelby County, which encompasses Memphis, the results were the inverse. Biden won with 64%. Traditionally, the city, 64% black and 29% white, is a blue stronghold in a sea of red. People from various backgrounds who have lived there describe a segregated world, one steeped in a rich culture, but ever tiptoeing around that tension. It's the home of Sun Studio, where B.B. King and Elvis Presley recorded, and Stax Records, the label of Otis Redding and Booker T. and the MGs. Tourists flock to Beale Street, Graceland, and the National Civil Rights Museum. But as that museum, itself built around the Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, showcases, Memphis suffers from a persistent conflict between race and power. Last year, Shelby County commissioners declared racism a public health crisis. Memphis has had this complicated relationship with race in the South. It has wanted always to be better, but has always struggled to figure out how to do that. One of the ways you can see this is for years there were two separate school systems, says Jesse Holland, an assistant professor at George Washington University's School of Media and Public Affairs, pointing to the differences between the county school system of mostly white kids who wanted for nothing and the city system of mostly black kids who wanted for everything. Growing up in the 1970s, Holland, as part of a school integration effort in Memphis, was bused to the Colonial Acres neighborhood to attend Sea Isle Elementary instead of Hanley Elementary in his neighborhood of Orange Mound, the first neighborhood in America that was built for African Americans by African Americans. Just like many other places in the South, When the schools were desegregated, the affluent whites, the ones who could afford to, ran away to the private school system. Poplar Avenue stretches the entirety of Memphis. Its route at the edge of the Mississippi River downtown is the oldest part of the city, a working-class enclave that cradles the seat of the city government and the Walter L. Bailey Jr. Criminal Justice Center. As you head east, there is a noticeable shift. Fast food restaurants and bail bond joints give way to a large Catholic school, a Presbyterian church, and due north, Rhodes College. Once you reach Midtown, you'll start to see a really solid enclave of solidly middle-class and upper-class homes, says Charles McKinney, an associate professor of history and the Neville Frierson Bryan Chair of Africana Studies at Rhodes College. When you get to Chickasaw Gardens, it just gets whiter and whiter and whiter. Continuing east on Poplar, past Chickasaw Gardens, is River Oaks, where Dobbs grew up on Shady Grove Road, in a mansion with a lake. Between the two neighborhoods is Belle Mead, where he and his wife, Catherine, live today in an 11,500-square-foot house that Zillow values at $2.3 million. Southwest of Chickasaw Gardens is Orange Mound, the neighborhood where Holland grew up. As a child, you were warned, these are places you can go, these are places you can't go. You are to stay within the boundaries of Orange Mound. I understand why parents and adults would tell you this as a young black child, because there are areas in Memphis that you could go into that they were afraid you would never come back from, says Holland. Still, to this day, I don't go to Chickasaw Gardens. Last June, just months into the COVID-19 pandemic, which has disproportionately impacted communities of color, and as the George Floyd and Black Lives Matter protest reached a crescendo across the country, Shelby County commissioners approved a resolution that declared racism a pandemic, too, and committed to policies that unequivocally defend minorities and aim to eradicate the effects of systemic racism affecting black people and other minorities. The overall poverty rate in Memphis, according to a 2020 report from University of Memphis researchers, with data that predates the pandemic, is 21.7%. Broken down by race, gulfs in prosperity come into focus. Among blacks and Hispanics, Latinos, the poverty rates were, respectively, 26.1% and 29.2%. In contrast, the poverty rate among non-Hispanic whites in Memphis was in the single digits, at 9.3%. Similarly, for non-Hispanic white Memphians, the median household income was $69,395 relative to $35,668 for black households and $38,864 for Hispanic Latino households. The differences between the poverty rates of minority groups and non-Hispanic whites are striking, the authors of the study wrote, pointing out that Memphis ranks second for child poverty and is the second poorest metro area with a population greater than 1 million. The disparities between non-Hispanic whites and blacks are much more severe than nationally, they emphasized, and this is cause for great concern. The stratification within Memphis is layered. As one Memphis native puts it, there's a big city, small town feel, within which the worlds get even smaller. You're either in the Memphis Country Club, or you're just kind of not, says a source who is the same generation as Dobbs and grew up with him in Memphis among the elite. And the Memphis Country Club is sort of a nexus of this white privilege for generations and generations. This is the world of Dobbs et al., a world where guest lists are never unfamiliar, one of charity boards and church, of golfing and hunting, of naming your sons iterations of Junior and the Third. Money grown on a tree. The family wealth goes back generations, according to a humble origin story on the Dobbs Equity Partners website. In 1921, James K. Dobbs took out a $25,000 loan and opened his first Ford auto dealership, alongside business partner Horace Hull. After just 3 years, the dealership was grossing over $1.25 million, approximately $19 million in 2021 dollars, and within 10 years, Dobbs sold that dealership for 10 times the loan value. Thus began the Dobbs family's three generations of successful investment in private companies. The family expanded into the restaurant and airline catering business. In 1998, Dobbs Automotive Group offloaded its 22 dealerships, a total that reportedly made it the third largest automotive retailer in the country at the time, to AutoNation for more than $200 million in stock. It takes acumen, persistence, planning, and some luck to build a successful business, but all of these and some incredible timing combined in spades to grow the Dobbs family dynasty, reads a 2014 story in the Memphis Business Journal. Most Memphians have heard of the Dobbs family. Barry Peltz, the co-owner of Corky's Barbecue, in which Dobbs Equity Partners began investing in 2018, declined to comment for this story. Among his cohort, John Dobbs Jr.'s resume is a study in predictability. He graduated from the prestigious all-boys Memphis University School in 1985, then went to Duke University, where he majored in political science, and closed the loop with a master's degree in business administration from the University of North Carolina. Now he boasts membership in the Young Presidents Organization, for, yes, Young Presidents of Businesses, and the International Order of St. Hubertus, a knightly order for hunters and conservationists. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia had been among a conclave of the men-only fraternity when he died of natural causes in 2016. The Children's Museum of Memphis campus became the Catherine and John Dobbs Family Center after the couple donated the largest single gift in the history of the museum, a gift that coincided with Dobbs' reign as King John. Carnival Memphis, his dominion, is a centerpiece of Memphis privilege, variously described to me as Mardi Gras light and just a lot of pomp and circumstance. Previously the Cotton Carnival, it began in 1931 to promote business and draw attention to cotton, which is still one of the region's cash crops and forever linked to the legacy of slavery. The carnival now is pitched as a philanthropic event to raise money for three local children's charities. The website boasts that it has hauled in more than $3.2 million with matching funds since 1999, or roughly one-seventh the cost of a Bombardier Challenger 300, which retails for about $2.4 million. Two of the three of the charities it supports, according to Executive Director Ed Galfsky, are in part dedicated to children who live in Orange Mound. Carnival Memphis also appears to be a fantastic opportunity for white Memphians to cosplay as royalty. Every year, a Memphis business tycoon is crowned king and paired with a young queen, typically a college-age woman who is there for decades the king's junior. For a week, they rule, but not before ponying up thousands of dollars for the honor. According to the July 2011 issue of RSVP magazine, the coronation of Dobbs went as follows. The evening began with a presentation of King John Hull Dobbs Jr. and Queen Kate Orgill Smith, whose long velvet train was carefully carried by her pages. Then the 36 princesses were presented, most of whom were accompanied by their fathers, with their escorts following close behind. After the royal court was assembled, the princesses and their escorts processed out of the room, and the next phase of the program began. Carnival kings and queens from years past were introduced and paid homage to the 2011 king and queen, after which the kings and queens of each of the grand crews, along with their dukes and duchesses, were presented. The Secret Order of the Boll Weevils was the last group to enter, and each member brought a segment of what was constructed into a huge boll weevil, behind which appeared a similar visage of King John and Queen Kate. It's pretend aristocracy, says a source. It's not like your average person in Memphis is coming out for the parade. A scroll through the names of past royals is a codex to Memphis's oldest and wealthiest families, and the Dobbses make many appearances. As Carnival Memphis celebrates our 80th anniversary, John Hall Dobbs Jr. has been chosen to reign as king to honor a very important industry in the Mid-South, the healthcare industry, which is an integral part of the area's economic base, reads Dobbs's king announcement from 2011. King John and his family have a great history with Carnival as well. His cousin, John C. Dobbs, also served as king of Carnival in 1984. Our king is a longtime member of the Grand Crew of Osiris and has stayed involved with the organization over the years. King John Dobbs started his Carnival involvement at a young age when he was a Carnival page in 1976 during the reign of King M. Carter Stovall and Queen Dorothy Dunavant. King John was the prince of the Memphis Country Club in 1986. His father, John H. Dobbs, Sr., was the recipient of the Cook Halley Award at last year's Business and Industry Salute. In 2017, Edward Johnstone Dobbs, John Jr.'s brother, was king. Despite the projected grandeur, sources paint a structure of a week-long country club bacchanal during which men dressed as boll weevils, an insect parasitic to cotton, run around causing mischief. The Secret Order of Boll Weevils was founded in 1966 as a secret society. The initial mission was to have mischievous fun with the Memphis Cotton Carnival elite, crash their parties, and make Memphis Cotton Carnival a little more colorful experience, much like real-life boll weevils creating mayhem on cotton crops. The Carnival Memphis website reads, though the boll weevils, too, have apparently evolved into a support group for what is known today as Carnival Memphis. Most importantly, though, today's boll weevil group is a community service group for the Mid-South. Donned with green capes and masks, they travel throughout the city on a green bus and a 1941 green fire truck with anonymity. Led by their evil eminence, Todd Brown, they visit retirement homes, hospitals, the less fortunate, those with disabilities, and many other facilities, helping spread joy and financial support wherever they go. But one former Memphis resident has a different take. You can't see their faces. They're drunk for a week. They pinch girls' butts. They grab you. They're just nasty. Another younger Memphis native, whose family still participates in Carnival Memphis, echoes the sentiment. You literally see these men trashed, preying on these young princesses. You're just keeping all of these misogynistic and racist traditions alive. The whiteness is overwhelming. I can sympathize with people who have a sanitized view of the past and want to celebrate what they consider to be the heyday of the Old South, says Holland. But when you think about what it took for that heyday to come about, why would anyone whose families had to sweat and bleed for their heyday to come about want to celebrate it with them? There has never been a black king or queen of Carnival Memphis, according to several people. When asked whether this was true, among specific questions regarding the connotations of cotton and boll weevils, the diversity of the organization, and certain carnival revelers stop the steel attendants, Gelfsky did not address the inquiries directly, but pointed to the organization's charitable work, adding, Carnival Memphis is not a political organization, has no political leanings, makes no political contributions, and has no political affiliations. We welcome people of all races, religions, sexual orientation, and backgrounds who share in that dedication to promoting the Mid-South as a great place to live and raising funds to better the lives of children in this community. If those who do not understand this mission want to criticize us, that is their business, Galfsky said. As an organization dedicated to fostering understanding, enjoyment, and involvement of the Memphis area's diverse population, we do not in any way condone violence or lawlessness or harassment of any kind. As McKinney notes, Memphis, on the banks of the Mississippi, cut its teeth as a distribution center, but it also functioned as a major hub for selling people into slavery. Those two things come together to shape the dynamics of race and power in Memphis, McKinney explains. The largest employer in Memphis is Federal Express, which reinforces that interplay, McKinney argues. We need low-wage workers. We need black people. We need black people encased in a lower socioeconomic caste, he says. That also puts the brakes on any sort of overly transformative evolution of racial dynamics in the city, since the need for labor in 2021 is really similar to the need for particular types of labor from 1921. This is the throwback that Carnival Memphis celebrates. A hashtag TBT to the days when white men ruled and black people picked cotton. It's not unique to Memphis. A lot of southern cities are trying to make this move, McKinney says. There's this veneer of inclusion, this veneer of civility, this veneer of this is an opportunity for us, in air quotes, to come together and celebrate our city, celebrate the region. But if you scratch the surface, no, it's not, right? Masters of the Universe. On the whole, Dobbs's plane gang is made up of very charismatic people, says a source who has various social connections to the individuals and is white. You would meet them and think, like, wow, that's a great person, as long as you didn't delve too deep into anything. A third-generation George, Zanone had a family farm in Horseshoe Lake, Arkansas, a literal plantation. And a business entity called Zanone Plantation, LLC, per court documents. According to an obituary, his father, George Zanone Jr., held considerable influence in his community and was also known for his generous southern hospitality, always welcoming friends to the lake house and hosting impromptu parties and dinners. A trail of legal documents show that George III earned a living operating hunting clubs, including more than 7,100 acres in eastern Arkansas. Prior to 1998, George Zanone III operated a duck hunting club on this land under the name of Green River Gun Club. His obituary notes that he split his time between Memphis and Horseshoe Lake, Arkansas, where he was a major sponsor of 4th of July fireworks. Vince Smith has established himself as one of the most prominent residential developers in the Memphis area. As of April 2020, he had three major projects underway in Lakeland and downtown and midtown Memphis. On its website, one of them, Museum Lofts, promotes proximity to the National Civil Rights Museum as an amenity. The biggest of the three, according to an article in the Memphis Business Journal, is Lakeland Commons, which is set to cost $42 million and include 150 residences and 21,000 square feet of retail. For at least a period, his wife, Khaki Valeria Smith, also pictured, dabbled in millinery after her fascination with headgear began with an article she saved about making hats, per an article in Memphis Magazine. While an apparent eponymous website is defunct, and her Etsy portal lists only one sale of a hat listed on the storefront back in June 2010, she has designed hats for weddings and Kentucky Derby parties, and even put together a giant poppy flower hat for a flower show gala. Like Dobbs, Carter Campbell and the McEwen brothers have all gone on into some variation of finance or investment. Campbell founded National Property Concepts to optimize bank branch properties with innovative solutions, like plopping a Starbucks inside a bank as brick-and-mortar banking becomes increasingly obsolete. Campbell sits on the board of trustees of Memphis's Presbyterian Day School, which strives to glorify God by developing boys in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. We have no information regarding the issue or incident, a spokesperson for the Presbyterian Day School said in response to a request for comment on Campbell and the rally. After stints with investment and development firms, Dan McEwen founded Maximum Hospitality, which manages upscale urban and boutique hotel properties with an obsession for maximum return on investment, according to the website. A spokesperson for Marriott declined to comment. A representative for Hilton told Vanity Fair that the Home2 property associated with McEwen's firm in Lubbock, Texas, is operated by a separate individual or entity. His older brother, Bob, rose through the ranks at Raymond James after the $1.2 billion acquisition of a smaller investment firm, Morgan Keegan, in 2012, creating one of the country's largest full-service wealth management and capital markets firms not headquartered on Wall Street. At the time of acquisition, Raymond James announced, Bob McEwen is sales manager of the rookie sales program. Raymond James did not respond to a request for comment. More recently, Bob was listed as the managing director of the company's fixed income capital market in a press release naming him as a member of the Chancellor Search Committee at the University of Mississippi. On Instagram, Bob follows a mix of Trump fan pages, even those dedicated to figures like Kayleigh McEnany and Candace Owens, and PAC pages such as @AmericaFirstGOP. Mixed in is a sprinkling of accounts featuring semi-nude women, such as Hotties Boating. On Twitter on January 13th, he liked a missive from the account of Conrad Black that read, "This will be the second impeachment proceeding where a full transcript exists exonerating the president." A day earlier, he did the same with a Nick Adams tweet that read, "There is no Republican Party without Donald J. Trump." They felt called. When Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016, many, mostly white, pundits tried to explain away his victory as a consequence of economic anxiety, perhaps an easier pill to swallow than the reality that his outwardly racist appeals had found an audience, one motivated to go to the polls. The Trump voter in a diner tropes became parody over Trump's 4 years in office, but even in the weeks following the January 6th Capitol attack, economic anxiety was trotted out as an explanation. A majority of the people arrested for the Capitol riot had a history of financial trouble, headlined an exclusive from the Washington Post. Trail of bankruptcies, tax problems, and bad debts raises questions for researchers trying to understand motivations for attack. While this may be true, it was surely not economic anxiety that prompted Dobbs and his crew to hop on his private jet and fly to Washington, D.C. the night before the Stop the Steal rally. Lined up against the nose of that jet, maskless, in finance bro regalia, the group seems far from money woes. Clearly, they went up there because they felt called, a current Memphis resident in the same social circle says. But called for what, exactly? According to a Capitol Police spokesperson, roughly 20,000 people were screened by the Secret Service at the Ellipse, where Trump held his Stop the Steal rally, and another approximately 10,000 to 15,000 people were estimated to be outside the metal detectors at the park. Per the spokesperson, the latest official count of the number of people believed to have breached the barriers and entered the Capitol is approximately 800. It goes to show, and more so than anything about Memphis, how the big lie that Trump put out there didn't just appeal to people who were middle income and lower or lesser education. This big lie attracted people that were well educated and have high income economic status. And I think that was true throughout the country, Congressman Steve Cohen, who represents Memphis's district, told Vanity Fair. It was an insurrection. It was a seditious effort to take over the government and manipulate the process so that the people's will wouldn't be heard through the Electoral College. The fact that people came up there that were educated and apparently supported such a proposition, although they might not have known what it was going to be like when they took off from Memphis, but just coming up there for Trump, and he'd been speaking for months, months before the election even, Cohen added. He had set the stage for so long. Cohen, who was in the gallery of the House chamber during the attack, added, "Anybody who did that had to understand that this was possibly an earth-shaking change that would be coming on that day, and that something was going to come other than just rhetoric." Something about Trump resonated with Dobbs enough for him to fuel up the jet. One source who knows Dobbs muses, "They want you to think that they're a bigger deal than they are." Another says, "As a human being, I would say, honestly, Dobbs is very Trumpy. He's into his brand. He's just wanting to be noticed. He wants to think that he's very attractive. He wants to be known." Holland, who does not know the people in the photograph personally, takes a broader view. "The difference between racist in the South and racist in the North is that racist in the North will stab you in the front. Racist in the South will stab you in the back and smile while doing it." The Southern genteel attitude is just a facade for a lot of people. That's one of the things that we've had to deal with in the South a lot, the presentation versus the reality. The 45th president has emboldened people who previously felt they had to mute their true feelings about race, as McKinney, who also doesn't know those pictured, puts it. As for why someone initially sent the picture to Vanity Fair and what the fallout may mean for the group, the answers come down to a desire to address systemic inequity. One person sums it up thusly: no one wants to rock the boat ever, even if it's not to be malicious or get back at someone, if it's just simply to hold people accountable for their behavior that they've perpetuated for decades. Club clout may be the best way to understand the type of economic anxiety that Dobbs and his plane load suffer from, one defined not by credit card payments and water bills, but by the status quo and the systems of inequity that undergird affluence and privilege. The type of people who attended the Stop the Steal rally, says McKinney, did not go about life in some sort of benign, neutral, and benevolent way, and then on January 5th they suddenly lost their minds. January 6th was an opportunity for them to articulate frustration with the loss of their racist president. But it was also a moment of sorts of affirmation and convention. It was a moment of congregation of like-minded people who have been engaged very explicitly in the work of subordination. Just like Memphis, the U.S. Capitol was built on the backs of African slavery. It is the highest disrespect to see insurrectionist damage and destroy historical buildings that would not be there without the effort, the sweat, and the blood of African slaves, says Holland. They showed no respect for the government for which they claim they are part of, and they're definitely not showing the respect for the efforts and the labor of the people who were forced to work on that building. Just like they very rarely show respect for the people who built Memphis into the way it is today. Awards Insider. TV rules the world. Up next, a special section devoted to TV's most sparkling stars and inspired creators, featuring Gillian Anderson and many more. Opening photo of Anderson by Tom Craig. Next photos, Fever Pitch. Ted Lasso, Jason Sudeikis, is unfailingly kind, even when met with a locker room full of players who initially want nothing to do with him. Dawn of the Ted. Ted Lasso, the culture clash comedy about an American football coach in England, made the case for kindness in a difficult year, by Anthony Bresnahan. Some might call Ted Lasso naive, but look, that kind of talk is not appreciated around here. Of all the shows that hit big this year, the Apple TV Plus comedy about the unflappable soccer coach brought the greatest and giddiest blast of optimism to an overwhelmingly grim year. As Ted, Jason Sudeikis was the friend that many of us needed. He became a word-of-mouth sensation because we just had to share. We certainly couldn't have predicted the dumpster fire that the year was going to be, says showrunner Bill Lawrence, Scrubs, who co-created Ted Lasso with Sudeikis. The whole writing staff talked about how the world, specifically social media and politics, had gotten to such a cynical, dark place that it was just pervasively gross. If I was to meet someone like Ted Lasso in real life, my first assumption would be, I can't wait for a week from now when this person reveals himself to be an asshole like everybody else. In the series, which returns for a second season on July 23rd, Ted proved that instinct wrong again and again. Just think of the biscuits he's secretly baking for team owner Rebecca. Hannah Waddingham pictured here, letting her think at first that they come from a store. When that person turns out to be actually kind and forgiving and empathetic and lovely, Lawrence says. Then you've got to look at yourself. Next photos, close talker, Juno Temples Keeley, the model girlfriend of one of the team's star players, is one of many characters who reveals new depths as the season continues. In the tank, Roy Kent, Brett Goldstein, is one of the first AFC Richmond players to buy in on Ted's ethos of kindness and convinces the rest of the team to get on board. Ted Lasso was precisely who he appeared to be, but curiously, he was the only one. By the end of the show, you saw each character very differently from how you initially saw them, says Juno Temple, who plays Keeley, a model and the girlfriend of AFC Richmond's narcissistic star player. Such a character might have been written as shallow and conniving in another program, Temple acknowledged, but the coach's sincerity brings out the hidden depths in everyone. The friendship that springs up between Temple and Waddingham's characters was a particularly central part of the show, and a welcome surprise in a story largely about sweaty men. That was a really precious thing to put on film, Temple says, but also one that happened off camera. Hannah Waddingham just being an extraordinary female goddess in my life. Ted Lasso was the real deal, even if he was fictional. The fantasy of the series was aspirational. Maybe there really are good people out there. Maybe we could be one of them. Now we move on to costumes. Past, present, there's more to period dress than corsets, as the designers behind some of this season's most beautifully attired series can attest. From recreating Halston fashion shows to duplicating The Rock's childhood athleisure, by Julie Miller. In the photos, checkmate, Taylor Joy in The Queen's Gambit. The Queen's Gambit, Netflix. Much of Beth Harmon's arc happens internally, her struggles after being orphaned, her plight as a female chess prodigy, her battle with addiction. Designer Gabrielle Bender uses color strategically to telegraph those struggles. Green, for instance, to mark when Anya Taylor-Joy's character lost her mother. then again when she seemed to heal. When she gets to Moscow in the final game, we came back to this green color to show that she is reconnected again, she says. Bender modeled other looks after different 1950s and 60s icons. Her early idols are Audrey Hepburn and Jean Seberg, says the designer. After Beth's mother dies, she finds more youth culture and goes to New York to connect more with Andy Warhol's factory style. For the show's final scenes, Bender wanted to signify Beth finally finding peace. The last costume scene is an ivory coat and sculptured hat made from alpaca wool, which when worn together softly emulate the silhouette of a chess queen. Says Bender, we wanted to make a point, but without losing the costume language of the whole series. Young Rock on NBC. In the photos, good idea, jeans, Bradley Constant as 15-year-old Johnson rocking an intense and period-perfect acid wash. Lisa Evans didn't have to look far when searching for inspiration for Young Rock, NBC's biographical sitcom about Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I started creating this database of thousands of images I found of him and quickly realized I would never be able to style this show any better, she says. The series bounces between the early 1980s, when the wrestler-turned-movie star was a child in Hawaii, the late 1980s, when Johnson was a high school student in Pennsylvania, the 1990s, when he played football at the University of Miami, and the not-so-distant future, when the fictional Johnson is running for president. He has not actually confirmed that he plans to run for office yet. Evans accommodated each storyline, whether the wardrobe called for retro wrestling gear, 80s sweaters, or a Woody Woodpecker starter jacket. She estimates that she relied on vintage clothing for about 60% of the wardrobe, while custom building the rest. I felt like we were recreating this moment that had this grounded authenticity feel to it, she says. Underground Railroad, Amazon, and in the photos, buttoned up, Thusamabedu as Cora. The Underground Railroad, based on Colson Whitehead's 2016 novel, depicts the antebellum-era path to freedom as a literal railway. Costumer Caroline Esslin naturally looked to history to inform her designs. I think we found every published daguerreotype, painting, drawing, etching of the enslaved that we could. The show's characters travel to several different states as their quest unfolds, all requiring a slightly different sartorial approach. Each state in the story is its own world, Esslin says. I am proud of the realism we achieved in Georgia. I am proud of the uniformity of South Carolina and the hybrid 1850s to 1880s world we built there. I'm proud of the wicked, dark, terrible world with a huge and almost grotesque 1830 sleeve that we built in North Carolina, the rugged, burned world of 1850s Tennessee, and the beauty and ease, if you will, of our progressive Indiana farm. Cora and Caesar, the story's central characters, do not have many personal choices, says Esslin. That explains their minimalist costumes, which cloak the characters through nightmarish journeys. Cora goes through the worst hell in this story, from cotton fields to swamps to wilderness and burned-out territory to underground train tunnels. She telegraphed Cora's journey by the wear in her wardrobe. We made many multiples of her pieces and aged them in the stages of her journey. We had dirt samples from all of our locations and used those dirt colors on the costumes. Halston, Netflix. In the photos, designed within reach, Jeriana San Juan brings a style icon back to life. Ewan McGregor channels the designer in a sumptuous new series, charting Halston's rise as a modernist and his fall, precipitated by impulsive business decisions before he died at age 57. Costume designer Jeriana San Juan had the daunting task of recreating Halston's personal closet as well as his most iconic designs. I wanted to highlight how evolved his aesthetic was, she says, and to show his collective tribe of collaborators as these bon vivants that were in juxtaposition to the rest of the world. San Juan was able to pick the brain of Halston's own head tailor, Gina Balsamo. It was pretty much the finding the needle in the haystack moment, she says. He came to my workroom and helped me literally develop the patterns to the pockets, to the jackets, exactly as he had for Halston himself. One favorite recreation was a long jacket with a sheen that the real-life Halston wore to an art opening. San Juan had the jacket made in patent leather. It did feel so futuristic, slick, and modern, and it expressed his creative, forward-thinking driving force in fashion. She also spoke to Chris Royer, a model for and good friend of Halston's, about the textures and fabrics he wore, how he occupied the space in a room, and the very unique way that Halston wore menswear. Says San Juan, he had such a sensitivity to fabric and to drape. Even his sports coats were often made out of a crepe wool, which is more traditionally used in women's wear to soften the shoulders of his designs. He created a unique pattern for his pants that was almost like 1940s sailor pants, which allows the fabric to drape more elegantly along the leg. Those little details helped clue me in on and develop a silhouette for him that captures that ease and elegance. Now we move on to music, changing their tunes. Five shows that used existing music in fascinating ways this season, from scoring gravity-defying pole dances with Megan Thee Stallion's rap songs to making a chamber piece out of an Ariana Grande hit, with illustrations of the actors and actresses by Dewey Saunders. Bridgerton, Netflix. Netflix's Regency-era drama made a splash for several reasons: its non-traditional casting, its steamy sex scenes, and its innovative take on classical music, which put a sophisticated sheen on recent hits by featuring orchestral arrangements of pop songs like Billie Eilish's Bad Guy, Maroon 5's Girls Like You, and Taylor Swift's Wildest Dreams, many performed by the Vitamin String Quartet. Music supervisor Alexander Patsavas said she pulled over 100 songs before finding the five that landed in season one. I love that the audience might not recognize it right away, but the song would sneak up on you, she says of the arrangements. Bridgerton's composer, Chris Bowers, cites the early 20th century French pianist and composer Maurice Ravel as a key influence. I wanted to make the score have as much of a modern feel to it as possible, he says. The cover of Ariana Grande's Thank You, Next, in the pilot, holds a special place in his heart, a shining example of Bridgerton's uncanny ability to combine worlds. I think it's my favorite because it's our introduction to the ball, to the grandeur of the storytelling, and to our covers project. And this was written by Chris Murphy. From Cassie DaCosta comes this, P-Valley, Stars. P-Valley's theme song, Down in the Valley, is a thrillingly bombastic introduction to playwright Katori Hall's series about strippers at a club called The Pink, located in the fictional Mississippi town of Chuckalissa. Developed from a demo by Memphis rapper Juicy Fruit, the sing-song nursery rhyme-esque opening bars slap, as they say. Music supervisors Stephanie Diaz-Matos and Sarah Bromberg collaborated with showrunner Hall to cultivate a trap noir or delta noir sound throughout the season, largely featuring songs performed by black female rappers. There is such a musical tapestry in the area, and I think the fact that it's a mythological city let us open things up a little bit, Diaz-Matos says. We hit hard all of our contacts, trying to find as many women, Southern artists from everywhere, from Texas to Florida to Atlanta. Their ambitious curation coincided with the latest explosion of women in rap. As Bromberg says, when we were doing the show at the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, Megan Thee Stallion, whose music Bromberg brought to the show, hadn't even been signed to a major label. And this from Katie Rich. Dickinson, Apple TV+. Emily Dickinson stands in an empty opera theater next to an accomplished soprano who warns that the spotlight is not everything she may want it to be. As in so many pivotal moments in Dickinson, the music accompanying the moment is modern. Light On, a 2018 single from Maggie Rogers. As hopeful and ambitious as our protagonist, the song bridges Dickinson's past and our present, cutting through period piece trappings to present the famous poet as someone viewers might know. DeVoe Yates, Dickinson's music supervisor, calls the show a very fun playground to work with. He began the season with a playlist of songs that fit its themes, from Eyesight to Fame, working with showrunner Alina Smith, to incorporate her specific request. She knew she wanted Light On featured somewhere, and combing through his selections to find, say, the right contemporary club song for a barn dance scene. It's Gone Blow by Cakes Tequila. Sometimes the songs are on the nose, and that's the point. A Liddy Kitty track called Serve It Up, for example, accompanies the preparation for a tea party at the Dickinson home. It just adds a layer of humor to the show, Yates says. Just having fun, really. And this also from Cassie DaCosta, Small Axe, Lovers Rock, Amazon. When Small Axe music supervisor Ed Bailey first met with director Steve McQueen about Lovers Rock, an installment of McQueen's ambitious film series, which focuses on a house party in the early 1980s, there was an awkward hitch. I was going in with the script all scribbled on, Bailey says, and just kind of, there are certain songs that you just can't have. No matter how much money we throw at it, no matter what we do, there are rights issues. Thankfully, what resulted was a compelling and imaginative playlist with a mix of essential hits, like Janet Kay's Silly Games and Carl Douglas's Kung Fu Fighting, as well as deep cuts from Crate Digging for dub reggae remixes. Bailey was inspired by McQueen's attention to detail. He was thinking about the smells of the room and the rumble of the wall, and are we going to see sweat dripping down the wall? Over the course of the party, the music transitions from airy lovers rock to bass-heavy dub, dotted with strategic gaps filled by characters who blissfully sing along. The fluidity of the experience that is caught on camera is genuine to the way that McQueen shot it, Bailey says. The energy and the room was like a real party at times. He made that event. And this special TV section will continue in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.